And so hello everybody, and welcome to the last cafe club of this year. Actually, to me the year ends in July. Today we have Kiati Malan, who is a postdoc at the Oscar Klein Center for Cosmoparticle Physics at the Stockholm University. Kiati, before got the PhD in Strasbourg, and is working on galactic dynamics, galactic archaeology, member of Gaia Collaborations, who is the core of the topic, I suppose, of your talk today, and also Sloan, Pan-STARR, Pristine, Spes, LAMMOS, and SIGGRAPH. Kiati, welcome, and when you're ready, you can start.
Yes, thank you so much for this opportunity. It's a real pleasure to be talking to all of you today. I must clarify that I'm not a member of the Gaia Collaboration. It's just a survey that I've worked with a lot and continue to work. But yes, CFIS and other surveys that you mentioned, that Pristine, that I'm an official member of. So today, I'll be talking to you about the LMS1 stream that we recently detected in the Gaia Early Data Release 3, which happens to be a fossil remnant of the early formation of our galaxy. So LMS1 stream, it appears that it accreted early in time, about 8 to 10 giga-years ago. So although I'm flashing on this first screen many streams that we have detected in Gaia EDR3, but LMS1 is a stream that I'm not showing here. I'll show that in subsequent slides, but I just thought of sharing with you this recent result of so many streams that we have detected using Stream Finder algorithm. I'll be talking a bit about it in the Gaia EDR3 dataset. So all the stars, all the objects, stars that you're seeing here are basically Gaia sources, color-coded according to their distances. So the blue streams or blue stars are closer to us, and the redder stars are further out into the halo. So the scope of today's presentation is that first I'll inspire that how stellar streams of the Milky Way are quite useful to understand the formation of our galactic halo. Then I'll talk about the detection of the LMS1 stream using the Stream Finder software and Gaia EDR3. And I'll also highlight the properties and the characteristics of this newly identified stream, basically perform a chemodynamic analysis. And then we'll try and understand that how the properties and characterization of the LMS1 stream advances our knowledge about the formation of the Milky Way halo. And in the end, we'll have time for some concluding remarks and discussion. So you may be devoted to different domains in astronomy, but I think one of the key questions that most of us are trying to understand is how do galactic halos form in our universe that is dominated by dark matter, right? So that's one of the fundamental questions. And the Lambda CDA model, it predicts that the Milky Way-like halos form via creation of multiple dark matter subhalos. This is in the only dark matter framework. When you go to hydrodynamical simulations, then basically massive dark matter subhalos can be translated as smaller galaxies that are accreted onto the Milky Way and populated its halo. The Lambda CDM simulation also, the Lambda CDM model also predicts that at higher redshifts, at more than about 1.5, the rate of accretion and merging was higher compared to recent times, compared to lower redshifts, when the accretion became more passive and more stationary. So these are the sort of predictions that we have from the Lambda CDM framework, but it is really hard to connect this theoretical prediction coming from the Lambda CDM model with the observations of the galaxy in the real world. And I think, as all of us know, that one of the main reasons that it's this connection is hard is because we cannot see dark matter, right? So for instance, if we observe our own Milky Way, this is what we see. We only see stars in any galaxy, let's say, in the Milky Way. So what we are seeing is a population of dwarf galaxies or satellite galaxies. And then there's a sparse population of stars in the halo, there's disk, at the center. And so basically what we are seeing are stars. But what Lambda CDM model is suggesting us that this is the real scenario. So if we could only turn on the dark matter switch, if it really exists, then the Lambda CDA model is telling us that this is what is happening in the underlying world. So there's lots of accretion happening. There are lots of dark matter subhalos and satellite galaxies that are continuously accreting onto the Milky Way and contributing to its halo population in terms of stars and dark matter. And this is what we want to understand. Right, so as I coming back to my original point, a Lambda CDM model predicts that a majority of stars and also dark matter in the Milky Way halo resulted from the accretion of several dwarf galaxies in the past. And this is what is known as the hierarchical growth of halos. Interestingly, many of these infalling dwarf galaxies that are not on very, very radial orbit, they form stellar streams. So as the progenitor galaxy, the original galaxy, it accretes onto the Milky Way. And if the accretion path is not very radial in nature, it would end up forming a stellar stream-like structure. And these stellar streams, merely the detection of these streams, provide a testimony of this hierarchical growth history of the halos, because we can actually visualize, we can really see these streams in the halo that are just populating the stellar halo of our galaxy. And the other interesting property of streams is that just by the nature of their structure, because streams closely delineate orbit in the galactic potential, we can basically trace these orbits backward in time and try and understand the path along which the original accretion took place, along which the progenitor galaxy came along. So this is the real power of stellar streams, that they closely delineate orbits, and we can try and reconstruct the emerging history of the galaxy using streams of our galaxy. So stellar streams provide an excellent opportunity to constrain this hierarchical formation history of the Milky Way halo that is predicted by the Lambda CDM model and is indeed most likely true. Now to talk a bit about the known dwarf galaxy streams of our galaxy that we already know of. So there are about 4 to 5 prominent dwarf galaxy streams in our galaxy. These are the Sagittarius stream, the Cetus stream, also the Orphan stream, Tucana 3 stream, and so on. But I think Sagittarius and Cetus are two of the most massive streams in our galaxy known so far. A common property among all of these streams is that they are dynamically young systems. By dynamically young, I mean that these systems, these streams were only recently accreted into the Milky Way, less than 3 to 6 giga years ago. So there are lots of lines of evidences that support this recent accretion scenario. But I think the two major evidences is that, one, that these streams are phase-space coherent. And one of the reasons that can explain their phase-space coherence is because they did not have enough time to phase mix, which implies that they must have only recently accreted into the Milky Way, because had they been accreted very early in time, then they would not be phase-space coherent because of phase mixing. And the other reason is that these streams have very large epicenters. So imagine if the Milky Way galaxy grew inside out, that means that the outside material must have accreted later on in time. That means only recently. And the fact that these streams have large epicenters imply that these streams must have accreted only recently. And that's why they're surrounding into the outer regions of the halo. So because most of the known streams in the galaxy are dynamically young, this raises a question that at present day, does the Milky Way contain signatures of dynamically old streams? So those streams that were accreted 8 to 10 giga years ago, for example. So is it that all these streams are just phase mixed and we can just forget that they can be detected even with the Gaia survey? Or is it that we just need a survey, an excellent survey like Gaia, and excellent tools to be able to dig out these very early accretions from the data sets? And it is the combination of these dynamically old and new streams put together that can provide a full chronological formation history of our galaxy. So that is one of the reasons that it's important to identify these old accretions as well, these dynamically old streams. And as I said, that the excellent astrometry of the Gaia data provides key to the detection of these dynamically old streams that were perhaps accreted 8 to 10 giga years ago, or even before that. So just to review a bit about the Gaia dataset. So I presume all of us know that Gaia is providing positions and proper motions and parallaxes and photometry for about 2 billion of stars, and also radial velocities for very few of these objects. So the Gaia data can be split into two data sets. The first data set is the 5T astrometry of about 1.8 billion objects, The second data set is smaller in size with only 7 million objects. So these are the brightest stars, or most of them are nearby stars. And our idea is to use this data set of Gaia to identify streams, because we want to find streams to understand the formation of the Milky Way. Now note that over 99.5% of stars in the Gaia data only have 5D astrometry. They don't have radial velocities, right? So there are lots of stars without radial velocities. And most of these stars without radial velocities are halo stars, because they're distant. So they had they are fainter stars, and therefore, at least the present data releases do not have radial velocities for these stars. So it's easy to use the 6D Gaia catalog to identify streams that are nearby, that are close to solar neighborhood, because we can basically convert the 6D heliocentric observables into energy and angular momentum, or energy and action space. And then we can try and identify the accretions as clustering in this energy angular momentum space. And this has been done in the past several times, to translate 6D heliocentric observables in energy angular momentum space, and then identify these clustering, because these clustering would mean that these objects originated from the same parent galaxy. So this has been done in the past. It's a straightforward exercise. But what is hard is the question that how to use the 5D astrometry, so to tackle with the missing radial velocity information and still be able to find stream in the Gaia dataset. So we realized back in 2017, when I started my PhD at Strasbourg, that we indeed need a dedicated software to find these halo streams in the Gaia dataset, keeping in mind how the Gaia data would look like, that there'll be 5D astrometry but no radial velocity. So this was the mindset with which I started my PhD back in 2017, to basically develop a state-of-the-art algorithm that can find streams in the Gaia dataset. So at its heart, what StreamFinder software is doing, that it is integrating orbit. So it samples for a given star, it samples over thousands of orbits, and it samples over the missing radial velocity space, and also takes into account the uncertainties in proper motion and parallaxes. So if you just look at this animation again, what StreamFinder is doing, that for a given star, it samples many, many orbits. So let's say this star, it's actually a stream star. So now StreamFinder will start to sample its orbit. And if you hit the right orbit, because you're sampling in a range, let's say you hit the right orbit of the star, then that orbit will see you through the remaining members of that stream. And because it has more friends now, this star will get a higher likelihood. But if the same star, for the same star, if you hit the wrong orbit, then that orbit will not see through the rest of the members. So this star will also get a lower likelihood. But yes, you eventually will prefer the high likelihood value. But if you try to integrate an orbit using a contaminant, using a field star, then no matter what orbit sample you choose, it will basically never see through any of the remaining stars, because it's a field star not associated with stream. So automatically this star, they get a lower likelihood value. So in this sense, each star in the Gaia dataset gets a higher likelihood and a lower likelihood value. And the higher likelihood value means that star must be a stream star. So the model parameters, in reality, the software is more complex, but at its heart, this is what the software is doing. So the model parameters are positions, proper motion, parallaxes, and also photometry, because once a stream is detected, we make sure that it's CMD is like that of expected from a dwarf galaxy or a globular cluster. And in doing so, we also take into account the contamination. So we build a contamination model using the Gaia data itself. So this is one of the recent results. So previously we have published many results using StreamFinder and Gaia, but this is the latest result from using StreamFinder on Gaia EDR3 dataset. And each star here is color-coded according to the latitude component of the proper motions to highlight the velocity coherence of these structures. And you can see that there are many, many streams, quite a few globular cluster streams as well. For example, the Fimbulthus stream of the Omega Centauri cluster, the stream from the M5 cluster, and so on, and many other streams that we detect. The full exposition of these streams and data set can be found in this paper that is now accepted. But the focus, the star of the show for today's talk, is the LMS1 stream that I'll now talk about. So we used Gaia EDR3, we used the StreamFinder algorithm to detect the LMS1 stream. So LMS1 is short for low mass Stream 1 that was originally discovered by independently by Yuan plus 20 and Naidu plus 20 using the Gaia data set itself. And the rest of the talk I'll devote to the characterization of the LMS1 stream, its chemistry, its dynamical analysis, what other Milky Way globular clusters and streams were likely accreted inside the LMS1's parent galaxy, and then eventually the role played by LMS1 in the formation of the Milky Way halo. So that's where I'll go with the rest of the talk. Right, so this is the map, the galactic map of once we gave the Gaia catalog to the stream finder and asked the algorithm to find broad stellar streams, so streams with broad physical width, such as those expected from dwarf galaxies. So it's just a parameter in the algorithm that if you set the physical width to say 20 parsec, you're bound to find narrow streams, such as those I showed before. And if you set a physical width to say 500 parsec, then you're bound to find broad streams. And this is exactly what happens in this map. So these maps are the top panel is color coded as per the longitude component of the proper motion, and the bottom plot is color coded as per the latitude component of proper motion. And you can see some of the stars and many of them forming stream structures. So we detected the previously known galactic antistellar structure, also the previously known orphan stream, also a part of the Sagittarius stream. But one of the streams that came out as one of the high confidence structure is the LMS1 stream that you can see here. So immediately we started to analyze the stream. So LMS1 has a broad physical width of about 750 parsec and lies at a distance of 20 kiloparsec from us. It has a very low metallicity, but a broad metallicity dispersion. And this together implies that LMS1 was produced from a dwarf galaxy. So it's a dwarf galaxy stream. And this metallicity also implies that the parent galaxy of LMS1 must have a stellar mass of about 10 to the 5 to 6 solar masses or so. Here I'm also showing the orbit of LMS1 that we computed. And there are lots of other structures that we've also found in the StreamFinder map that seems to be wraps of LMS1. So these are labeled as sub-1, sub-2, sub-3, that have their proper motions and their parallaxes and position sort of consistent with the orbit of LMS1 that you can see here. Also, the southern this agglomeration of stars in this region could indeed be the southern segment of the overall LMS1 structure that could be surrounding the inner Milky Way halo. So we do have the spectroscopic observations for the main segment of LMS1 that you can see here, but we didn't have spectroscopy for sub-3, sub-2, sub-1, and the southern part. So we are not 100% sure if they really belong to LMS1. But their CMDs and their positions and proper motions are consistent with that of LMS1, which seems to predict that the entire LMS1 stream could in fact be surrounding the inner Milky Way halo. The reason I should probably say that there are no stars in this region is because we simply removed the disk star, because otherwise StreamFinder becomes computationally very expensive. Right, so we take advantage of the 5D astrometry from Gaia. We cross-match the LMS1 stars with the SDSS, LAMOST, and Apogee to get the relative velocities and metallicity. And finally, we use the 6D phase space information to constrain the orbit of LMS1, and that orbit is shown here. And with this orbit, we found that the eccentricity of LMS1 is 0.2, which means LMS1 is on nearly circular orbit. It has a slight prograde motion. The epicenter of LMS1 is intriguingly quite low, so it's only 16 kiloparsec. And the pericenter is 10 kiloparsec. So these properties, the eccentricity and epicenter, are quite strange and interesting for LMS1, which is a dwarf galaxy stream. And I say it's strange is because almost all of the known intact dwarf galaxies of our galaxy and also other dwarf galaxy streams of our galaxy generally have quite high eccentricity of about more than 0.7, and which means that the other dwarf galaxies and streams are on quite radial orbits. And they also have epicenters of more than 35 to 40 kiloparsec. But these two values are quite low for the LMS1 stream, and that's why it's quite interesting. So the fact that LMS1 is on a circular orbit could mean could imply orbit circularization, which means that maybe the parent galaxy of LMS1 was a very massive system, and it accreted early in time, and due to the dynamical friction, its orbit got circularized, and that's why today it has a quite low eccentricity. The other thing was that LMS1's epicenter is quite low, and it could be that this could again be explained by the fact that maybe LMS1 accreted very early in time, perhaps 8 to 10 giga years ago, when Milky Way was much smaller in size. And since Milky Way grew inside out, the fact that LMS1 is contained in the very inner 10 to 20 kiloparsec region of the halo could mean that it accreted quite early on in Milky Way's time. The next thing we did is that we compared the orbits of these two globular clusters, NGC 5024 and 5053, with the orbit of LMS1. And these orbits are shown here in the position space, in the parallax space, in the proper motion space, and also in the line of sight velocity space. And you see that these orbits of these two clusters are quite similar to the orbit of LMS1, which is very interesting. Also, these two clusters, so this is the metallicity distribution function of LMS1 in blue, and these two globular clusters, 5024 and 5053, are shown here. So this coincidence in the orbit and also in the metallicity of these two globular clusters with LMS1 suggests that possibly these two globular clusters were accreted inside the parent LMS1 galaxy. I'm also showing two other objects, Indus and Palomar 5, and I'll talk about them in a couple of slides. So this orbit analysis suggests that at least these two globular clusters were likely accreted in the parent LMS1 galaxy. But the fact that these two globular clusters are associated with LMS1 also motivated us to search for other globular clusters and streams that were possibly also accreted in the parent LMS1 galaxy. And that we did by basically plotting some of the known streams and known globular clusters of the Milky Way in this action diamond space and in this energy angular momentum space. And as we know that the idea behind this diagram is that objects that are clustered together in these spaces were possibly accreted inside the same object. So we'll compare the distribution of the LMS1 with the distribution of globular cluster and streams, and the objects that overlap with LMS1 will mean that they came inside the parent LMS1 galaxy. And now I'm showing you that plot here. So the blue stars, the blue points correspond to the LMS1 simulation that I ran, and they occupy this region of the space, in this action diamond space, and also in this energy angular momentum space. The stars denote the globular clusters, of which the three golden stars here are the three globular clusters that overlap with the LMS1 simulation, the action space, and the energy space. And the other stream, Indus, probably you're aware of it, also overlaps with the LMS1 distribution in the energy action space. So this means that these four objects, in addition to 5053 and 5024, Palomar 5 and Indus are also associated with the LMS1 and were possibly accreted inside the LMS1 parent galaxy. Also, as you can see here, the CMDs of at least 5024, 5053 and Indus, and also their metallicity quite nicely are consistent with the metallicity and CMD of the LMS1 stars that you can see here. So this analysis suggests that NGC 5024, 5053 and Indus, and possibly also Palomar 5, although Palomar 5 is slightly different, has a slightly different CMD, slightly more metal rich. But at least these three objects were likely accreted inside the parent galaxy of LMS1. Now coming to some sort of perspective analysis, we have these three polar dwarf galaxy streams in the Milky Way now, in addition to LMS1. So we have the Sagittarius stream, which is also the famous Sagittarius stream that also has a very polar orbit. So its orbit is nearly perpendicular to the plane of the galaxy, to the disk. It's inclined at an angle of 76 degrees. 90 degrees would mean exactly perpendicular to the disk. Then we have Cetus stream, also on a fairly perpendicular orbit, polar orbit. And then we now have LMS1, also on a polar orbit. So these three are quite prominent dwarf galaxy streams of our galaxy, with Sagittarius occupying the outer galactic halo, Cetus occupying the intermediate galactic halo and LMS1 spanning the very inner central galactic halo of the Milky Way. They are a bit metal poor also. Sagittarius has a broad metallicity dispersion, not so for Cetus and LMS1. And we all, I think most of us know that Sagittarius contributed many, many globular clusters to the Milky Way, about 8 to 10 globular clusters. Cetus contributed at least one globular cluster, 5824. And we've seen that LMS1 contributed at least 3 objects or probably 4 objects to the Milky Way. And models and analysis have suggested that Sagittarius accreted maybe 3 to 5 gigayears ago. Cetus probably accreted also 3 to 5 gigayears ago, depending on which simulation you believe. And LMS1 seems to have accreted 8 to 10 gigayears ago, given its orbit, given its epicenter and the region it occupies in the Milky Way galaxy. So one of the things that I'm currently trying to understand is just from the top of mind, is that, is it really the case that the LMS1 that surrounds the inner halo of our galaxy accreted very early in time? And this was followed by the Cetus stream that occupies the intermediate halo and was accreted after LMS1. And then finally, Sagittarius that occupies the outer halo of our galaxy was then only recently accreted. Is it really the case? From these analyses, it does appear to be the case that LMS1 was one of the early accretions and Sagittarius is one of the recent accretions. But it's hard to be 100% sure about that. So maybe we need to do more of chemodynamical digging to really understand these three systems. Also, other question that I'm trying to understand right now, it would be nice to have your input on this, that we can follow up in discussion, is that we have these three polar dwarf galaxy streams in the Milky Way galaxy, right? So one of the things I was trying to understand is that how common are such polar dwarf galaxy streams in the Milky Way mass galaxies in the cosmological simulations? And the reason I was thinking about this question, I'm not sure about the merit of this question, but it's just something I'm wondering about, is that if in cosmological simulations, if we find out that these polar dwarf galaxy streams are indeed common, then is it that these polar streams are in fact the major source of stellar population in Milky Way mass galaxies? And if in cosmological simulation we find that these polar streams are uncommon, then is it that our Milky Way is a special galaxy in some way, that it hosts at least 3 polar, nearly polar dwarf galaxy streams? So I think that could be a good question to pursue, but I'm not sure about the merit of this question. But anyway, I think I have not exceeded too much of time, but just to summarize these results, is that stellar streams are the object that provide direct evidence of the hierarchical formation of the Milky Way galaxy. And among the known stellar streams of the Milky Way, LMS1 seems to be an interesting stellar stream. It has a very unique orbit, a polar orbit and a low eccentricity orbit, and has a low epicenter, not observed in any other dwarf galaxies or dwarf galaxy streams. It possibly accreted quite early in time. It has a halo mass of about dark matter halo mass of about 10 to the 9 to 10 solar masses. There's also evidence we find that LMS1 is completely wrapped around the inner galactic halo, but we need spectroscopic confirmation. LMS1 seems to have brought in NGC 5024, 5053, and Indus, as supported by the CMD comparison, the orbit comparison, the metallicity comparison, and possibly also Palomar 5. But it could be that Palomar 5's orbit is precessing, so although it overlaps in the energy action space, but maybe has a different orbit inclination, not orbit inclination, but a different orbit phase now. So in conclusion, LMS1 is an important fossil remnant of the early formation of our galaxy and an important contributor to the stellar population of the Milky Way. With that, I thank you so much for your attention.
Thank you, Kiati, for this very, very, very nice talk. I've been impressed by the number of publications you quoted with your name since 2018. So I suppose when you were PhD students.
Yes, I completed PhD.
Quite unusual to my experience. Well, I have some questions, but any comment or question before by the audience? Maybe I can start. Well, your last question you asked about the expected number of polar streams in cosmological simulations. Are you thinking about some specific cosmological simulation? I suppose you need not necessarily covering very large scales, but with very high resolution and eventually also with hydrodynamics?
Yes. No, I mean, that's really a good question. So until now, I have played with Illustris and TNG simulations in the past, but not particularly in trying to probe this problem or trying to understand this problem. So this is not something that I've started to work on. I'm working on right now, but this is just something in the back of my mind that I like to follow up myself or probably with others who have probably thought about a similar problem. But I think I think in February or March, TNG 50 was released publicly, but I'm not sure about the number of Milky Way like galaxies that TNG 50 simulation would have. So maybe a hydrodynamical simulation like TNG 50 could be useful. What do you think? Do you have experience with some of these simulations?
Not me directly.
Okay. So yes, I think TNG 50 could be useful. Not because so like many. you said that we need a simulation that has high enough resolution that stream particles can be detected and seen, right? Which will not be possible in a low resolution simulation. So maybe TNG 50.
Maybe Katarina wished to comment about that. See your hand, right?
Yeah, actually, so many thanks for a nice talk. So I have just a quick comment on TNG 50 or whatever this kind of size of a simulation. I think you would have there roughly about tens, maybe even close to 100 Milky Way-like objects. So I think it should be possible, although I'm not sure that still the resolution is enough for what you want to do, but I think it's worth trying. But I had a question, so it's totally not my domain of expertise, but I had maybe some curiosity question. Like I was wondering, I guess all these streams can be a really powerful also tool to test alternative models of dark matter, right?
Yes.
So I was wondering whether with your algorithm, whether you could try to put some constraints, like for example, on a relatively simple and still discussed MOND model or something like that.
Right. Just to first comment on the in regard to simulations, it's really good to know. I didn't know that one could at least find 100 Milky Way like galaxies in that simulation. But I think that would also depend the way you probably select galaxies, in the sense that, okay, maybe you can put a constraint that give me galaxies from 10 to the 12 to 2 times 10 to the 12, so overall virial mass or something, and you'll get a sample. But maybe then you want to put constraints that, okay, it should also have an LMC, okay, it should also have had a Gaia Enceladus-like merger, and then maybe the number of simulations decrease, because you want to have a sample of Milky Way-like galaxies that are also observationally motivated. But yes, I mean, it's totally, this is something that try and pursue in future. In regard to the MOND thing, so there are many people, Rodrigo from Strasbourg and Benoit Femme also in Strasbourg have thought about this problem a lot, using streams to constrain models of MOND, for example. They have worked on it. They also have publications on it based on streams. So it would be, so I should say that, I mean, the stream finder algorithm, it's already a bit of a complicated algorithm, in the sense that for the algorithm itself, it's really hard to identify the full stream, right? So for instance, here you see that the LMS1 stream, we cannot guarantee the detection of all the stars in our stream, because stream finder is developed with the mindset that, okay, give us a stream, give us some hint of a stream and in the Gaia catalog, and then maybe we'll go back to the original Gaia data set and then try to pick out more members from the Gaia catalog and so on. So it gives us probably 80% of the real stream structure, maybe 50% of the real stream structure, and then one needs to return to the data set to find stream. Theories such as MOND, I think what simulations suggest is that for stream, for example, if I'm correct, that what MOND is telling for a Palomar 5-like stream is that maybe there would be asymmetry in the two tidal tails, for example. So these are very subtle signatures that a stream would have in a MOND scenario. And I think for stream finder alone, it will be really hard to detect such subtle differences in the structure of the same stream. But yes, once we have found streams that we have, for example, we have many streams, we can now get the spectroscopic observation of these streams, build a 60 phase space distribution of these streams, and then try and run n-body simulations in Mon-like scenario, and then try and constrain the parameters of the Mon. I'm not sure if I've answered your question, but does it make sense?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I would have a few very flashing questions, if I can. First one, can you give some more information about the stream model and the contamination model, the first question. The second one is, did you validate this algorithm on simulations? And the very last, maybe a question more interesting, can you validate a posteriori the orbits that you extract from with your algorithm, looking at the gaseous emission in the location of the orbits with some other instrument?
Could you repeat your final question, please?
Well, can you validate or check the streams, the location of the streams that you identify with some observable, looking at the in gaseous emission, the same region?
I'll try and answer
some inertia, right, of the mass, and so maybe the gas is flowing in the same direction, so with all the reasons.
I'll try and answer. So the second question, I think your second question was, has a stream finder been tested mm-hmm. on simulations?
Mm-hmm.
So that has been done in the past. That originally the stream finder was tested on realistic n-body simulations of streams. That was done in the original paper that I've highlighted here. So to say more about this likelihood function, maybe that may describe. So this P stream theta, so theta has many parameters, right? So theta contains that once you integrate an orbit, compare that orbit with the positions of the stars, with the proper motions of the stars, with the parallax of the star, and make sure that it is consistent with this 5D astrometry of all the stars. So when you integrate the orbit, you would compare that or the orbit of this star with the positions of all of this star in the data set, with the positions, proper motion, parallax, and so on. And once you have some candidate members that belong to a given stream based on the orbit, then you would draw a CMD internally in the algorithm. You would draw a CMD or a stellar population model, and then basically check if the stellar population model could belong to some isochrone model. So for instance, one of the ways, so the way that StreamFinder actually runs is that you also choose an isochrone model of a given metallicity, say -2, because you're interested in finding globular cluster streams, and globular clusters have low metallicity. So you'll go to Padova model or some website, and you'll download an isochrone model, maybe of -2 metallicity, maybe of 12 gigayear, age of 12 gigayear, and now you have that isochrone model. So once you have this candidate member, so here, for example, in the Sandy Nation, there were these five members, you'll plot up a CMD, you'll plot up that model, isochrone model, and then also have a probability term that what is the likelihood of all of these stars belonging to this isochrone model. So even if your isochrone model is wrong, then you'll have a lower probability. But if you had your right isochrone model, then that CMD probability term that is over here, that will also boost up your probability. So that's why I have written photometry here as well. So the 5D astrometry of Gaia plus the 5D astrometry of Gaia plus the 5D photometry from Gaia goes here. And then there's this contamination term. So what contamination term is doing, it's basically applying Gaussian mixture model in the position space, in the color magnitude space, in the parallax space, and also in the proper motion space. And at a given position, let's say you're analyzing the star, so you get a position in the position, proper motion, parallax, and photometry, and then you can choose the Gaussian mixture model that has been approximated in a given patch of the sky, and then also get the approximate probability of the contamination. Because, I mean, stream finder ultimately boils down to finding smaller high density features of an overlying background, right? So that's how, I mean, it's basically, so contamination model is basically Gaussian mixture model of the data in this 5D astrometry plus the plus in the CMD space, if it makes sense.
Thank you. And a lot of the possibility to validate the streams are looking at the...
I have personally never dealt with a data set.
Would it be possible with some data set and instrument? I don't know.
Possibly. I mean, so I should admit with you that I've never actually looked at a data set that gives information about gas, for example. But yes, I think it would be possible. So for example, I mean, in principle, it should be possible you could just, instead of using the phase space information of stars, you use the phase space information of gas, and then basically run the algorithm using that. I think fundamentally,
you have the location where you're supposed to have the stream, so you can blindly follow it.
True. And especially, I mean, now that we have globular cluster, so we know that globular cluster would have some gas, probably some gas remnants. So we can... But
eventually some gas in between, I mean. That's
in between the stream, you mean, for example, here?
Along the stream.
Along the stream, yes. So I think it, in principle, fundamentally, it should be possible, yes. But, I mean, it's an interesting question. I've not thought about it, but yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Kathy. Any question or comment maybe by people working in this field? If not, I don't see other question. Maybe we can stop here. That's fine. So Kiati, thank you very much.